Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jeannie Lee from the University of Arizona. Today, our guest is Dr. Michael Bordash from the University of Chicago. Michael is a scholar of modern Japanese literature. His new book, A Fictional Commons, Natsume Soseki and the Properties of Modern Literature, was published by Duke University Press this year. This book focuses on the famous early modern Japanese writer Natsume Soseki and how literature provided a venue for Soseki to comprehend and reimagine the new property law, wealth, or in an even larger context, modernity. So welcome, Michael. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today on the channel.
Thank you so much for having me, Jingyi. I'm delighted to be here.
So you've written quite a few books on Japanese literature throughout your career. Recently, what has your research interest been?
Lately, I've been working on a new project, thinking about the Cold War and trying to rethink what Japanese literature, culture, film, music of the Cold War era means. I'm not happy with the way that that era, including in my own work, how that era has been studied. So I'm trying to do it in a more interesting way.
Sounds like a great topic. And for our listeners who may not be familiar with Japanese literature or the protagonist of this book, Natsume Soseki, could you give us a brief introduction of him?
Sure. Soseki is usually, I should maybe start with his dates. He was born in 1867. He died in 1916, so just about a century ago. He's usually proclaimed as Japan's greatest modern novelist. Of course, there's some critics that really hate him, but for the most part, I think it's pretty common to claim him as the greatest or one of the greatest. And I think in recent years, we're also starting to realize more that he was also a really important theorist of literature, someone who stood back from literature and tried to think what literature was. He's best known for about a dozen full-length novels that were published in the last decade of his life. I think another thing to say about him is he's unusual in that he's critically acclaimed both during his lifetime and ever since as one of the great novelists of modern Japan. But he's also always been really popular and remains really popular today. People read him for pleasure today in Japan very, very commonly. Usually a writer has to choose. You can be really popular or you can be really, really critically acclaimed, but you can't be both. But he's one of the rare ones that is actually both. And when I introduce him to my students, I always bring a 1,000 yen note from the period of 1984 to 2004. His face was on the 1,000 yen note in Japan, which gives you a sense of how important he was in Japan. I think in the United States, the best a writer can do is a postage stamp. But in Japan, his face was actually on the money. I guess a couple of other things I'd say about him is one of the things that's very common for people to point out is he belongs to the last generation who received sort of a traditional education, primary education, memorizing the Chinese classics by rote, learning to recite, and then in his adolescence sort of switched to the modern European-based education system, went through the elite university system. So he really was lived through the transition from one sort of intellectual and cultural world to another intellectual cultural world and felt at home or felt not at home in both of them kind of equally, but that that historical background is really crucial, I think, to his understanding. And for me, he's just my favorite writer in the world. And I first discovered him in 1984 when I went to Japan for the first time as an exchange student, and I'd read some Japanese literature before I went to Japan. I'd read Kawabata and Tanizaki and Mishima and folks like that, and to be honest, I hadn't really liked them very much. And I got to Japan and I met the teachers who were going to be working with me for my year in Sendai, and one of my teachers, Matsumoto Sensei, I asked him what I should read next. And I told him what I had read, and he said, you should read Soseki. And I went downtown in Sendai to the Maruzen bookstore and bought a copy of Kusamakura, or The Three-Cornered World in Alan Turney's translation, just following Matsumoto Sensei's recommendation, and started reading it on the bus on the way back to campus that afternoon, and couldn't stop reading it, and sort of stayed awake late in the night reading the book straight through, and then went to bed and woke up in the morning and read it again, and I thought it was the most interesting book I'd ever read. And I always wonder if Matsumoto Sensei had said I should read someone else like Mori Ogai or Akutagawa or someone like that, I probably would not have become a professor of Japanese literature. I don't know if it was just coincidence. Maybe he told everyone to read Natsume Soseki, but the fact that he pointed me in that direction was really decisive for me in my life.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. I'm glad you picked up that book that day. I know a lot of my students from the Japanese language class always mention their first encounter with Japanese literature was Natsume Soseki's Wagahai wa Neko Dearu, I am a cat, which is interesting that they read the book and they decided to get into studying Japanese language, which is modern Japanese language is a bit different from the kind of language that Soseki was using.
It's true, although I've also found he's easy to read in Japanese. I don't think I Am a Cat is necessarily easy to read, but his later works, I don't know why this is. When I read him, as a non-native speaker of Japanese, I don't have to use the dictionary as often as I do with even some contemporary writers. So his prose is older, but there's something, at least for me, that's very lucid and I know exactly what he's trying to say. Oftentimes I feel, and I don't always feel that way with Japanese writers.
Well, that's great. So you mentioned Natsume Soseki has been such an important figure in Japanese literature, and there have been numerous studies on him as well. But your book focuses on the role of the property system, which I think is a not so often seen topic in Soseki studies. So what prompted you to write on this topic?
You're right that there's a lot of work on Natsume Soseki. It's kind of daunting if you look at the Japanese scholarship, because there's literally thousands of books and tens of thousands of articles on him. And it feels like absolutely everything that could be said about Natsume Soseki has probably already been said. So it is hard to find something new to say. And for myself, I actually, when I was in grad school, thinking about my dissertation, I thought about writing about Soseki, but deliberately decided not to do that, in part because it was hard to think of something new to say about him, and in part because I loved his work so much that I didn't want to turn it into work. I didn't want to turn Soseki into something I had to do as part of my day job, and so decided to write my dissertation about Shimazaki Tosun, another writer, and then later on, with some trepidation, decided to try to do some serious work on Soseki. I remember sort of very clearly when the idea for this project came together in my mind. It was about 1998 or 1999. And I'd been thinking about William James and Natsume Soseki. Natsume Soseki knew William James's work very well and engaged with it in a number of ways. As I was thinking about this relationship, I was reading a book by Walter Ben Michaels called The Gold Standard and the Logic of Naturalism about American naturalism. And I came across a sentence in there that said that William James was an advocate of what C.B. McPherson calls possessive individualism. The doctrine of political philosophy, but a philosophy in general that arises from people like John Locke and others that presumes that our basic relationship to ourself is a relationship of ownership. And so I got this idea that ownership, and particularly ownership of the self, was really central to William James. And I wondered what that meant in terms of Soseki's own understanding of William James. And then at the same time, I was editing a translation of Kame Hideo's book, Transformations of Sensibility, the Phenomenology of Meiji Literature. And I encountered there a discussion by Kame about how Meiji literary and scholarly discourses often use property systems as a kind of yardstick for measuring the degree of civilization and enlightenment that a given society has taken. And so having encountered this description of William James as an advocate of possessive individualism, and then this description of Meiji literature as working around a notion that there's a kind of social Darwinistic evolution of society based on property systems, a light bulb went on over my head that this might be a way to think about Natsume Soseki, because all of his works more or less revolve around property disputes and the question of self-ownership. And just as Soseki had lived through this radical transformation in education systems, he'd also lived through this really dramatic transformation of Japan's property ownership regimes. And so he had an awareness that ownership systems are contingent, that the ownership systems that we have aren't written in stone. They can be changed. They can be transformed. So I got the idea to use this as a way of thinking about Soseki. I got a Japan Foundation fellowship to spend a year at Tohoku University in Sendai, which is where Soseki's library is housed. And so I went there from 2000 to 2001 and spent a year sort of retracing Soseki's own intellectual journey, looking at his books, the books that he had read, looking at the marginalia that he had written in the books, and used that to try to figure out how Soseki thought about these questions. And after that, there was a long and winding path between that research 20 years ago and then the publication of the book. A lot of other projects intervened along the way, including a translation that I co-edited of Soseki's Theory of Literature. And as I thought about this project, it started to grow new arms and legs and started to get bigger and bigger. I started thinking maybe it should be a book about world literature and property. But then about 3 or 4 years ago, decided basically I should just go back to the original conception of the book and finish it up. And so I was able to do that. I think the thing that I learned about this through this process is don't take 25 years on a book. That's the wrong way to write it. So if there's one lesson I can pass on, it's don't do that.
Cool. I guess I'll make sure to keep that advice in mind when I try to turn my dissertation into a book. Don't take 25 years.
No, don't do it.
So you speak of this property system that was very important to Soseki. What's the social context of this new property system that was installed in 1898? What major changes did it bring? And what about new problems that emerged from this new law?
Yeah, as I discuss in the book, there was a set of really massive reforms that the new Meiji government undertook as it tried to transform Japan from a weak country that was really on the verge of being colonized into what became the major imperial power in the region. And these transformations, I think, in many ways revolved around property systems. The reforms in the property system had an impact on just about every aspect of life in Meiji Japan. The central political issue of the day was the unequal treaties that Japan had signed in the 1850s and wanted to revise to get itself recognized as being the equal of the European imperial powers. And getting the unequal treaties revised required bringing Japan's economy into sync with the economies of the other great powers. And the property, the reform of the property system was a major component of that. We have the Civil Code from 1898, as you mentioned. We have the Berne Treaty for Intellectual Property Rights. We have a lot of major reforms of the property system carried out throughout the era. It all starts in the early 1870s with the reform of the taxation system, that there's a changeover from a taxation system in which taxes are paid in kind as a percentage of the crop yield that's produced on farmland. That's the old system. The new system is paid in cash, and it's based on the value of land as property. It starts with the presumption that land is alienable property that has a cash value. The reforms continued through the Meiji Constitution and the institution of national elections and the National Diet in 1890. To vote in the elections, you had to be male, you had to be 25, and you had to be a property owner. Then we have the Meiji Civil Code in 1898. And from the 1890s and after the turn of the century, increasingly, we see the extension of this new property regime into Japan's empire, its expanding empire. It's both a technology of imperial domination, like the British Empire and other empires before it. Japan knows that one of the ways to control a colony is to institute a new property system in the colony. And it's also an ideology of civilization and enlightenment. It becomes one of the ideologies used to supposedly demonstrate Japan's advanced civilization and thereby justify its colonization. So we have all these legal system, these changes in the legal system, and at the same time we have intellectual discourses of individualism, Rishin Shusei, success. We have new modern disciplines like sociology, law, psychology, history. All of these involve new ideas of property ownership. And so in intellectual life, cultural life, legal practices, daily life, we see the new property system, you know, having an enormous impact. One sort of concrete instance of how the property system really changed everything was the plummeting divorce rates in Japan after 1898 as a result of the Civil Code and the way it redefined the family as the basic unit of property ownership. Before 1898, Japan had one of the highest divorce rates in the world, and this was considered scandalous. It was considered a huge problem. After 1898, the new property regime made divorce almost impossible. And after that, we get the birth of the myth that Japanese people don't get divorced, which is usually explained through things like traditional cultural values or reasons like that. But I think in many ways, it's really a result of this new property system.
It sounds like a very, very important change in Japan's history. And I think I've seen quite a few studies talking about this new system from the aspects of economic history or political history. But until I read your book, it never really clicked for me that this theme appeared in many of Soseki's works. So in the book, you argue that Soseki sought to interpret and reimagine or imagine beyond this property law. What are some of the works that represent this attempt and how did he do it?
Yeah, the basic argument in the book, as you said, is that both in his fiction and in his literary theory, Soseki was thinking about and practicing literature as the site of a different kind of economy, a different set of practices, different modes for sharing and for belonging that were alternatives to what was becoming the modern common sense of the property regime. His novels all more or less revolve around questions of property ownership. The plots are set in motion when somebody dies and property is inherited, or there are more metaphorical questions about self-ownership. Do we really own ourselves? Can we own ourselves? And also, narratives about the family system. Do family members, are they the property of the family? Do, for instance, women belong to their husbands or to their fathers? What is the status of a female subject in terms of property? All of these elements of the property system become, these are the raw materials out of which Soseki builds his stories. And sometimes this gets very explicit. There's, if you read I Am a Cat, which we've already mentioned, there are these really wonderful passages where the cat just directly criticizes human property systems in the Meiji period. It's a parody of anthropology and sociology. The cat is like this participant observer who's looking at the property systems of Meiji Japan and saying, this is barbaric. These people are immoral. They have, you know, they're completely uncivilized because they don't understand property. So we see this in his stories, both, you know, explicitly and implicitly using the property system as a way to create interesting stories. But I think we also see it in his literary theory. One of the most interesting and strange elements of Soseki's career is this book called The Theory of Literature, which is a massive attempt that he published in 1907 to create a fully scientific theory of literature that would be valid in all times and all places. And the model that he comes up with to describe what literature is, I talk about at length in the book, and it's kind of hard to explain. But I think we can see that model for understanding literature as being a challenge to the basic norms of possessive individualism. I think Soseki explicitly tries to describe literature as an inherently shared experience. It's an experience that doesn't belong to the author. It doesn't belong to the fictional characters in the work. It doesn't belong to the reader. It's an experience that emerges through the shared coming together of those three streams of consciousness into a single stream of consciousness. And that we can't understand what literature is without thinking about this experience that's shared in common. And so in some ways, that's the source of the title of my book, A Fictional Commons, is trying to think about literature itself as a place for practicing something other than a private property regime.
Fascinating. And this searching for self that you mentioned sort of connects to my next question. In chapter two, you turn to literature that may be conceived as a kind of madness or loss of self. I guess in a way, I am a cat can be interpreted that way, the loss of self in a cat or vice versa. And this is related to the rise of the modern discipline of psychology. Can you talk more about this part?
Sure. Soseki, you know, in addition to being, you know, a great novelist and theorist of literature, was also keenly interested in science in his day. And he was colleagues and friends with some of the scientists who founded the discipline of psychology in Japan. He was really there at the beginning of psychology as a new academic discipline. He studied directly with Motohiro Yujiro at Tokyo Imperial University, the founder of modern psychology in Japan. His classmates include people like Matsumoto Matataro, who were, again, really fundamental figures in establishing psychology as a new scientific discipline. And so when Soseki decided that he wanted to pursue this fully scientific theory of literature, one of the things he did to prepare for that was to undertake a pretty extensive survey of this new science of psychology. And he read extensively in the works of people like William James, who I've already mentioned, but also Wilhelm Wundt and many other people who were working in the laboratory trying to create this new science of the mind and of our consciousness. And in reading through these works, Soseki was continually, I think, encountering the ways in which this new discipline of psychology used possessive individualism as one of its basic assumptions. When you read psychology from the late 19th and early 20th century, you constantly find property systems used as a metaphor for explaining our psychic operations. It's like one of the central metaphors of psychology in this period, and particularly the early William James. It's hard to go more than a page or two without coming across another use of property as the basic metaphor for explaining how our psyches work. So Soseki encountered that, but he also encountered, I think, expressions of skepticism over this model, and you can find that particularly in later William James, in works like Varieties of Religious Experience. And so Soseki's narratives, the stories that he writes, frequently explore this issue. He oftentimes writes about characters who feel entirely alienated not only from the world around them, but also from themselves. They feel unable not just to own property, and Soseki's characters are continually losing their property, but also unable to own their own selves. They feel uncertain, an uncertain relationship in terms of how they should be relating to themselves. He also writes narratives that suggest different kinds of economies and different kinds of systems beyond private property. I argue that some of his narratives should be thought of as constituting gift economies. The commons, a sort of cooperative sharing model, is another system that we see suggested in his works. And so if we look at a novel like Kokoro, one of his most famous works, the last half of Kokoro literally takes the form of a last will and testament of a man trying to pass on his property to another person. But the thing he's trying to pass on is actually a wealth of personal experiences. His own life experience is the property that he's trying to pass on to the reader of that will. I think we see Soseki sort of playing with the structures of property and thinking about how we understand our own psychologies and our own individuality or in our own consciousness as through systems of ownership, and also seeing that that doesn't always work. And there's a famous, Soseki was always associating literature with madness. There's a famous passage in the preface to The Theory of Literature where he cites his own severe bouts of what he calls neurasthenia as being the source of his gift of literature, that it's thanks to his madness that he's able to write. I think in a sense, if the property system, as it was becoming common sense in this period, was one of the figures that was available to describe what rationality or sanity looked like, madness became a place for exploring what something else would look like, what something that would not be a property system. And I think for Soseki, this was really central to his idea of what literature should be.
I want to connect this next part with what you mentioned earlier about his theory of literature. So he explores the meaning of literature in a sociological sense as well, other than talking about madness and the loss of self. And we know that during this time of Japanese literature, there were writers and intellectuals trying to approach this issue of literature from many different aspects, considering the influences that they were getting from Europe. Soseki is one of those who approached through science. There are many others who tried to explain literature from aspects of philosophy and aesthetics theories. But how did Soseki respond to modern norms of property through his theories of literature and knowledge in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and part of this, we should think about how he used sociology in the theory. I think he was trying to think about literature as a distinct realm of experience that we share in the modern world. And again, he was interested in coming up with a universal scientific theory of literature that would be valid in all places and all times. A theory that you could apply to classical Chinese philosophical texts and to contemporary romantic novels. What was the thing that they all shared? And part of this for him was a certain kind of psychological experience that a reader undergoes when reading a text, but he was also keenly aware that our responses as readers to texts was in part determined by the cultures and the societies in which we lived, that we are shaped by the world around us, and that our ways of feeling and responding to literary texts are determined in part by the place and time in which we read. There's a wonderful sentence in The Theory of Literature where he says, maybe someday Shakespeare will be forgotten. that the experience of reading Shakespeare is not necessarily a universal experience. Certain people at certain places and certain times read Shakespeare and have that intense experience of literature, but he's able to conceive that there might be societies structured in different ways where people would read Shakespeare and not have that experience of literature, and then Shakespeare would stop being literature at that point. So in putting together his theory of literature, as I've already said, he did a fairly extensive survey of psychology as it existed in 1900 to 1902 when he was doing this work. And then he also did a survey of the new discipline of sociology as it was emerging in this time period as a new academic discipline. And mostly the works he read as part of this survey came out of the Anglo-American sort of Spencerian liberal tradition of sociology. And they tended to stress that property systems were an important stepping stone in civilization, that you could, in looking at social structures and public morality, the development of a private property system was one of the ways to measure how far a society had come along in sort of a social Darwinistic model of civilization. And of course, in these Anglo-American texts that he was reading, Western Europe was perceived as having reached the highest stage, and everything else around the world was perceived as being at a more backward stage. And so he read this. He borrowed a lot of this sociology for his theory and was really interested in trying to think about how the structure of society impacts the way that we read literature. But he was also fairly skeptical of the sociology that he read. And looking at the books that he owned, in particular, when we come to passages where European sociologists are talking about Japan, you can start to see the smoke coming out of Soseki's ears. He gets really angry at the way Japan is being objectified as an object of sociological knowledge. And I think he was much more skeptical of sociology than he was of the psychology he was reading. And it's interesting, I write about it in the book, I think this skepticism towards that sort of liberal Anglo-American tradition of sociology was in fact shared by a new generation of sociologists that were emerging on the European continent at the same time, people like Max Weber and Emile Durkheim and Marcel Mauss, who were much more skeptical about the condition of modern European society and much less inclined to celebrate European modernity and instead think about the pathologies of modernity and to look for alternative models in other societies. And Soseki never read those sociologists. They weren't introduced into Japan until really after his death. But I think, and I argue in the book, that when we read his fiction, we can see parallels between the kind of sociological imagination that Soseki is using to write his fiction and the kinds of ideas that were being developed by this new generation of sociologists. So in one of my chapters, I argue that Mauss's theory of the gift and the notion of a gift economy provides a really useful way of thinking about Soseki's novel Until the Spring Equinox and Beyond, which, and Soseki, of course, had not read Mauss, but I think that there's some really interesting parallels in the sociological imagination. And then I think the other thing to point out is that when Soseki tries to define what literature is scientifically in terms of sociology, he explicitly rejects the kind of social Darwinistic model of sort of civilization and enlightenment in the realm of literature. He sort of buys that model as maybe that explains how economies work, maybe that explains how science works, but that model doesn't work for literature. He insists, and he says this quite explicitly in a number of places in his work, that literature is a domain that changes through time, and it's constantly changing, but it does not follow a teleological model. It's not developing to higher and higher, more advanced and more civilizational forms. And for Soseki, I think that way of thinking about literature was really crucial to him, that literature followed a different set of norms that weren't necessarily progressive. And again, I think this is tied into his skepticism about the private property system that developed.
And how does his exploration of sociology relate to his reaction to colonialism in literature, or I guess in society in general, because we're talking about private ownership, and colonialism is very much about owning other people's body and other people's property. So how does Soseki respond to colonialism? How does he criticize it through his literary works?
That's a really important question. And, you know, I think we can say, for starters, that Soseki was keenly aware of what we would call something like British cultural imperialism. And the claims, and, you know, he was a scholar of British literature, and so this was a domain in which he worked and lived professionally. He was highly suspicious of claims for an inherent cultural superiority of British literature and British culture, particularly in relationship to Japan and the rest of Asia. So in that sense, I think he was keenly aware of issues of colonial domination. But I also don't think that we can say that Soseki criticized colonialism in his works when it came to the Japanese Empire. The most egregious example we have of this is the travelogue he published depicting his 1909 journey through Manchuria and Korea, in which he seems to reproduce all of the racist stereotypes that were circulating in the Japanese Empire about Chinese and Koreans, and seems to be partaking in Japanese imperialist discourse. You know, I think it's important to remember that Soseki was part of the social elite of Meiji Japan, had come through really the very highest track of education. And the people that were running the empire were his classmates and friends. He was very familiar with the bureaucrats who were running the Japanese empire. The colonies show up frequently in his works, as they do in the works of most writers from this of his generation from Japan. And so it's hard, I think, to find a direct critique of colonialism in his work. And that's one of the reasons that, for example, Korean scholars like Park Yu-ha and Cho Yong-il are very critical of Soseki. They see his participation in Japanese imperialism, and I don't think that they're wrong. But I think that we can also find a sense in his works during, you know, and of course he's writing during the period of the Japanese Empire's greatest expansion, this sense that something is going terribly wrong in Japan as it transforms itself into the regional imperial power. Many people point to his lecture, The Civilization of Modern-Day Japan, as one of the places where we can really see this discomfort that Soseki has, this sense of dread that he has about how things are going in Japan. And many people have read that lecture and other pieces by Soseki is really sort of foreshadowing the coming disaster of fascism and World War II, that there's a sense that he sees the direction Japan is moving in, including its expansion in Asia, and sees that it's heading in a terrible place. And so in the book, the place where I most explicitly take this up is in my discussion of his novel, Kokoro. Kokoro was serialized in 1914 in the Asahi newspaper. Like all of Soseki's major novels, it was originally printed in daily installments in a newspaper. And so by appearing in the newspaper in 1914, it coincided with really what was one of the most violent phases in Japan's colonization of Korea. This is the period of the Land Cadastral Survey, when Japan had annexed Korea in 1910 and started to impose a new property regime on the colony, which provoked often violent resistance to Japanese rule. And in the book, I sort of trace how we can see in the pages of the Asahi newspaper in early 1914, on one page, we have the latest installment of Kokoro, and then on the next page, we have a story about the violence of imperialism and the clear unhappiness of the Korean people with the imposition of the new property system there. And the novel, Kokoro, ends with this really dark sense of a decisive change that has been taking place in Japan. The character Sensei, who narrates the second half of the novel, tells a story about how when he was a young man, he feared that he was going to be the victim of theft. And as a result of this fear and paranoia, he spent his entire life suspicious of everyone around him and unable to trust the people around him. And then, to his horror, realizes that he was the thief all along, that he was precisely what he was most afraid of. And this leads to his suicide at the end of the novel. And I think one way we can read the novel is as being kind of an allegory for Japan itself. A Japan which at the beginning of the Meiji period feared that it was going to be the victim of dispossession, that it was going to be colonized at the hands of the imperial powers. And now in 1914, coming to the end of the Meiji period, comes to the horrible realization that perhaps it's been the thief all along. And again, this isn't a direct condemnation of colonialism in Soseki's works, but I think it's a place where we can see his, whether it's conscious or unconscious on his part, his real sense that something is going disastrously wrong. And I think that this involves the empire and of course, the property systems.
That's a really great point. Now, how does Soseki's interpretation of the property law fit in the broader intellectual environment at this time? As a member of the literary field, or in Japanese, the bundan, did his discussion of contemporary issues have any effect on his fellow intellectuals and fellow novelists?
I think the answer is yes and no. His theoretical works, particularly the theory of literature, were not terribly influential at the time. People found, particularly the theory of literature, just to be strange. I think people still find it strange. It's an absolutely insane work. It's one of the reasons I and my co-translators wanted to tackle it, because it's just such a strange work. And that didn't have, people read it, but I don't think it had that much impact. But his literary fiction, on the other hand, was of course enormously influential, both on a generation of newspaper readers and also on literary critics, and in particular on a coterie of young writers and thinkers that gathered around Soseki and who would come to dominate Japanese intellectual and cultural life in the decades after his death. And his critique of modern society, his sense that ethically something was going wrong, was, I think, enormously influential. But I also think in many ways, particularly as his disciples became the primary interpreters of Soseki's legacy, that many of the more radical aspects of his critique were ignored or misunderstood. And when I came upon the idea of thinking about Soseki in relationship to property systems and thinking of his work as a kind of critique of modern norms of property ownership, I had what I thought was the really smart idea of going to look and see what proletarian literature writers and critics must have thought of Soseki. Because in a sense, if I'm right, and Soseki's works should be thought of as really a critical intervention in the rise of this new property system, then in a way, the proletarian literature writers should be the next stage or the heirs to Soseki's project. And I was surprised to find out that, in fact, they almost entirely ignored Natsume Soseki. There's almost nothing in the enormous body of important literary criticism and other kinds of writings that came out of the proletarian literature movement. And so in that sense, I think if we think of his critique of private property wasn't carried on, or he wasn't seen as a source, an intellectual inspiration for later critics who explicitly took up questions of capitalism and the property system. But I think that there's all the way through, both during his lifetime and the decades after his lifetime and in the last 50 years as well, there's a long tradition that's intact of thinking of Soseki's writings as constituting a really important ethical critique of modern society and as being someone who really analyzed skillfully and in creative ways the pathologies of alienation and dislocation that a modern society, including its property system, produces. So in that sense, I think he has had an impact.
So historically, did any of the problems that he pointed out got solved or improved during the years to come?
The I mean, I think, you know, the property system continued to be central. I gave you a narrative at the beginning of how the property system developed. I think in some ways we can see 1925 as the moment when the modern property system really achieved its mature form. That's when the property qualification was removed for voting. You didn't have to own property to vote. You still had to be male and an adult to vote in the elections. But at the same time, the new peace preservation law made it illegal to question, to suggest the overthrow of the private property system in Japan. It literally became a thought crime to suggest that the capitalist property regime should be overthrown. So that it not only became common sense, it became illegal to question the regime. I think in many ways, as the kinds of questions that Soseki was wrestling with, we're still very much wrestling with today when we look at the internet and the ways that online culture intersects with our economy, the questions of who owns what, when we deal in social media, who has the property stake in it. These are still questions that we're still wrestling with. And there are still attempts, I think, to naturalize certain forms of property ownership as being just the way things are supposed to be. And one of the things I think Soseki still, you know, still speaks to us today is to remind us that no, there are lots of ways to organize property regimes, and there are lots of ways to imagine different alternative ways of organizing our societies and our cultures.
Now, how should we understand Soseki's concern as a man of the modern age? This property law, under the influence of, you know, the civilization and enlightenment campaign, it's supposed to represent something new, something forward, something that's more advanced. But Soseki clearly didn't like it. So what do you think that Soseki's concern about the property law may reflect some of his contemporaries' concerns about Japan's modernization process?
Yeah, I mean, the initial, I think, response to Soseki, both in Japan and then outside of Japan, as he was introduced in translation to other places, the initial response was to celebrate him as the first great modern Japanese novelist, that he was seen as the one in Japan in the process of the emergence of modernity, after decades of experimentation with this thing called the modern novel. He was the one who got it right, was the first one to really master the modern novel. And so he was the first modern in modern Japanese literature. I think in more recent decades, this view has been revised, but in some ways, it's we're getting the mirror image of it, which is it's not so much a celebration of Soseki as the first great modern writer, but a celebration of Soseki as the first great critic of modernity in Japan, the first person who really put their fingers on what was wrong with modernity or the problems of modernity. And the people who celebrated Soseki as the first great modern novelist, I always think of them, I think that they're celebrating him as the last great novelist of the 19th century. And they want to put him together with great writers like Flaubert and Tolstoy and show that he sort of carried the torch of 19th century realist psychological realism. I prefer the second view of Soseki as the first great critic of modernity. And in that sense, rather than thinking of him as the last great novelist of the 19th century, I always prefer to think of him as the first great novelist of the 20th century. And in the book, you'll see that without directly doing this, I'm constantly setting him alongside writers like Kafka, James Joyce, Gertrude Stein, who I think are his real peers. I think Soseki was really one of the founders of what we now call modernism, you know, which is ironically literature that, you know, reflects very critically on the assumptions that have become modern sense in modernity. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that he still speaks so strongly to us. It's one of the reasons that high school students and college students in Japan still love Soseki and seek out his works to read, even when they're not required to read his works. And as someone who's really loved Soseki for the last 40 years. And you know, I said at the beginning how I really think this discovery for me of Soseki changed the course of my life. It's gratifying to finally see in the English-speaking world, I think people are starting to catch up to Soseki in the English-speaking world. We're starting to see more translations of his work. We're starting to see, I think, a greater recognition of his, how his importance and of what a unique and interesting figure he was. And in that we're still very much living in the property regime that Soseki understood and whose introduction he lived through. I think his writings are still extremely relevant to us as we still try to figure out what other possibilities might exist for imagining some sort of different way of living in the world.
Well, I hope your book encourages more readers to get interested in Soseki and maybe pay more attention to the problems with the property law in Japan.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking your time to talk with us about your new book.
Well, this was fun. Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me, Jingyi.
Thank you. And for our listeners, to learn more about Natsume Soseki and modern Japanese literature or Japan's modern property law, make sure to check out this new book, A Fictional Commons, Natsume Soseki and the Properties of Modern Literature by Dr. Michael Burdash. This is Jingyi from New Books in Japanese Studies, and I will see you in our next episode.